Hello from the BBC World Service and welcome to the latest edition of the Documentary Podcast. Every week we bring you a range of stories from our presenters and reporters across the world. If you have the time, please rate the documentary on your podcast app and leave us a comment. Let us know what you think.
This is the BBC World Service. My name is Nicola Klaase and I served as Sweden's ambassador to the UK for 6 years. The role of modern ambassadors is to inform our governments about the situation in our country of residence. Today's diplomats are expected to reach out to a much broader constituency in an effort to understand the mood of a nation. But many of us would privately admit we don't go to enough places or meet enough different kinds of people. So I thought it would be interesting to revisit Britain as an expeditionary diplomat.
Ship, ship, ship! Come on, chip, 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 chip.
David Crockett is a British farmer.
Right. No, this is Northern Ireland here. Okay. And through that, there, that's a republic there.
So we are now standing in Northern Ireland, but if we take a few steps in that direction, we will be in Ireland, but we are still on your land.
Yes. Yes, that's correct. That's correct, yes. Yes, correct. We'll go up the border ditch here, and then you'll see a gate across up here. And that's when my grandfather saw the first effects of partition, it was called then. He was grazing the cows in this field here, and then the field that we're going up to here, you know, the gate across. He was bringing the cows down. It would have been on the beginning of the financial year, 1923. He's bringing the cows in for milking. They're coming down through the gate. And a customs man said, that's the last day you do that.
Like David Crockett's farm, Britishness is a fascinating concept which defies stereotype.
But how does it feel to have a land border across your land?
Well, see, I know no different. I work with two different governments. I suppose I would like it if it wasn't that way, but that's the way it is. And simply it's that way because having two different, you know, land both sides of the border, we could never sell it and go and buy another farm anywhere else because we wouldn't get enough money for it because nobody wants the bother of it. The two different countries, all the complications. So then the price of the land that you were selling wouldn't have bought you anywhere else.
The family land has been in each of these two separate countries, but life has gone on.
As you cross into Ireland, what are the differences that you notice?
The only difference you see is kilometres. All the signs in the Republic are in kilometres, and Northern Ireland, they're all in miles. Look, money, I have euros, I have sterling, all in the one pocket. If I go to buy a packet of sweets in the north, I hand them the sterling, and if I go to the Republic, I hand them the euros.
It's 18 months since I left London. Britain has voted to leave the European Union and is trying to work out the best way to achieve that. So what is Britain?
Well, it is a unique combination in the world of four nations in one nation, with no written constitution, which is a mystery to many other people in the world. And yet it works. The relationship of each part with England is different from the others.
That's William Hague, Lord Hague, a former British Foreign Secretary, former leader of the Conservative Party. I asked him to explain his view of the relation between the four nations, Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales and England.
In Scotland, this was a voluntary combination with England. Scotland decided in the early 18th century to join with England in the United Kingdom. And it comes the closest to deciding not to be with England anymore. Although, thankfully, for the immediate future, that threat has receded. So Scotland, I think, has this strong sense of it can go its own way. It is distinct from England. Wales did not voluntarily associate itself with England. It became conquered by England. And Wales is much more anglicised. And yet, because of its geography and the survival of the Welsh language, has a distinct cultural identity, but not as strong a political identity as Scotland. And, of course, for Northern Ireland, the key milestones, well, the most important one is really in 1690 and the battles between Catholic and Protestant leaders that were resolved in favour of a Protestant presence and population in the north of Ireland. That has been the basis for the political boundaries, Northern Ireland being part of the United Kingdom, the partition of Ireland in the 20th century, all arose from what happened at that time. So there are different milestones in different centuries that determine the relationship today between those parts of the United Kingdom and England.
So the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, four nations in one, all inside the single market and the customs union of the EU, which is why there are no border checkpoints on David Crockett's farm. Though he still can't be certain what Brexit will mean as he crosses the border to move from one part of his farm to another.
Do you think nationality becomes more or less important when you have a border on your land?
I just look at it from a business sense. You know, nationality doesn't help you if you go down, if there come a checkpoint down there and you says, well, I'm British, you know, and I have a ground out here, you know, or I'm Irish and, you know, want to come up here. They'll just look at you. Well, that's tough. I don't care what you are. You still, and it doesn't make any difference. Doesn't make any difference.
When you're walking across your land, you don't think that now I'm in the area now where I'm in Ireland and...
No. Simply because I've been living here all my life, so I class myself as, you know, if somebody says, are you British or are you Irish? Well, and I say, oh, no, I'm a European.
Why do you say that?
Well, that cuts out. Nobody knows then whether you're Protestant, Catholic, British, or what you are, you know, European, that covers everything.
But if they say, but OK, you're a European, but you have to be something more than European, what would you say then?
Well, I said, no, I'm not. I'll say, right, I have a British passport, and I pay my taxes to Britain, you know, and that's how British I am.
It's complicated. So I asked William Hague how he would define Britishness.
I think the word I would emphasise in defining Britishness is fairness, a sense of fairness. That's very strong in the British character. Hopefully this is strong in most nations' characters. But British people particularly dislike being treated in some unfair way. But they do not like being treated in some way that they think is not fair to them. And this has been at the heart of the Brexit debate. Here we are, this very internationally minded people on the whole, enterprising people on the whole, and yet we decide to leave the European Union. And at the heart of this is a sense of not being treated fairly.
But of course there's no objective standard of fairness, and then it quickly becomes a question of emotions.
We're one of the poorest areas in Britain, and yet people still voted out.
That's Mark Williams. He's a postman in Port Talbot, in Wales.
Some of it, I think, was down... People were concerned about the steelworks, and they fell under the apprehension that if we weren't in the EU, then the British government would put money into the steelworks and keep it afloat. It's a very industrial town, always has been. It's been built predominantly on the steel industry. We have the second largest steelworks in Europe, which is clearly visible from anywhere in town.
As a postman, Mark knows a lot about what's going on in the town.
You've seen somebody who can be trusted then, because you're trusted with the mail. And equally, people rely on you to keep an eye out if you see somebody that you know shouldn't be there and they're fiddling with the back door or something, you're going to tell somebody. So you've seen a sort of a secure member of the community then who's the eyes and ears of what's going on very often.
Mark fears that technology is changing his world of work.
When I started, there wasn't even a mobile phone. So the thing is, we had call boxes. So the thing is, if you wanted contact with people, 9 times out of 10, you waited for the postman to turn up. Whereas with the advances with technology, I think that's changed dramatically. Even in the last 2 years, it's changed dramatically. Well, but the youngsters don't value a postman in the same way as what the elder generation did. Frankly, it's looking like George Orwell's 1984, where I could even be replaced by a robot or a drone. So this is how bad things are getting. So the thing is, any community spirit that's left is going to be sort of eaten away if the worst case scenario does happen and all these jobs are thrown on the scrap heap and replaced by a robot.
So how does Mark identify himself in that context?
First and foremost, I present myself as somebody who's from Port Talbot. Then I count myself as Welsh, and then I count myself as British, in that order. But that doesn't mean I've got anything against anybody from anywhere else in Britain, because some of my best friends are English.
In Scotland, you are likely to get a very different answer.
You get to speak to people from all walks of life every day.
Edinburgh hairdressers Alan and Eileen.
You get the job end result there and then, on the day, like several times a day.
Yeah, definitely.
It's a brilliant job.
That is, it's really rewarding when you see how happy people are. You know, they could come in miserable, they've had a hard day, or they've had a disaster somewhere else, whatever reasons, and then you just...
So you're a psychologist sort of thing, or people's coming for therapy.
Yeah, I guess.
People tell their hairdresser everything because they know that they won't see you in their own life outside of the salon. So people will confess and tell you things that they wouldn't even tell their best friend. It is quite extraordinary, the things people tell you.
Yeah.
Between the clients, I was told a very long time ago, never speak politics with your clients.
Or religion.
Religion or politics is just a no-no. So what we try and do here is, if someone wants to talk to us about it, we listen, but we don't ever...
judge.
We don't judge, and we don't tend to give them too many opinions that we have. Because...
you have to try and remain a bit more neutral, in that ground.
I was about to say, we hear so many different opinions and so many thoughts from people. It is absolutely
mad. You can't really choose a side when it comes to that.
So for us, we're hearing so many different sides and worries and concerns and opinions that we generally are very neutral about it all, because there's so many things that
you can't. Yeah, you just can't, because then you don't want to offend a client because they won't come back at the end of the day.
And you can see everyone's point as well, which is why I'm even more confused about how I feel about politics.
Yeah. It's hard to make a firm decision because they've all got their own agendas, and you'll only see the best of these parties or whatever, you know, these individuals. You don't really see the bad stuff unless the press give it to you. It's a hard one. Because not one person... Well, look at the divide. It was literally 50-50. I mean, that...
Yeah, people are very confused. I mean, I am.
Not just Brexit, but the independence for Scotland.
Alan and Aileen reel off a list of Scottish symbols for me.
Bagpipes,
tartan.
Kilt, tartan.
Highland.
Speaking Scottish slang.
Haggis.
Edinburgh, the castle.
Lochs.
Lots of lochs.
Glens.
But they had an interesting view when it came to deciding whether they themselves were British.
Never said, I'm British.
It depends.
I always say I'm Scottish. I don't know why. It seems more...
I'm Scottish, but I'm still part of the UK, but I'm also European, I'm also British.
Yeah.
I'm also a human being on this planet. So I am all of these things. Yeah, I'm all of them. I'm not just Scottish.
I say I'm Scottish. A Welshman would maybe say he's Welsh. And an Englishman would say he's from England. But really, we're the UK. But I think if somebody asks you that question, I mean, oh, where are you from? I go, oh, I'm from Edinburgh in Scotland. Or, you know, what's your nationality? Oh, I'm Scottish. But I wouldn't mean... oh, I'm just in Scotland. I don't say British. That's what I'm trying to say.
If someone says to me British, I just immediately think of the royal family.
So do I.
And that's just what comes
into
my head.
I just think of Bunting and, you know, the Jubilee. Or the Queen.
I just think of the royal family and being British.
Buckingham Palace.
Buckingham Palace, London.
So being British is at best a secondary identity for some in Scotland and Wales, but that reference to the royal family takes us to another commonly assumed characteristic of being British. You're either part of an aristocracy passing on hereditary wealth through the generations, or you're not. Two classes neatly drawn.
Well done, you found your way around. Come on in.
This is the front door of the
house. That's Caroline. I went to meet her at a beautiful old manor. The estate is featured in the BBC TV series Poldark, a popular historical drama set in the 18th century about Ross Poldark, who returns to Cornwall after the American Revolutionary War.
This is quite an amazing place. How large is it? I mean, how many bedrooms are there?
We've got 21 bedrooms.
But don't be deceived. This isn't a luxury lifestyle.
It's not terribly comfortable to come and stay because it's jolly cold. We had some people staying and they said they woke up and they actually found that the bit of the duvet had got ice on the outside. The heating and the boiler's broken. Last year we found it cheaper to send my parents away on a cruise than heat the house.
Here's Caroline, living in an Elizabethan manor with her parents, sister and brother, struggling to pay for the heating. Work for Caroline, and I believe her when she says it's hard work, is renting out the place for filming and events, as well as private functions such as weddings and funerals, and twice a week showing visitors around who are fascinated by the houses of the apparently wealthy and the history of people who live in them.
They think if you live in a big house that you are going to be totally different to them. And then in a way, you can see them in the background and say, oh, look, they've got exactly the same, whatever it happens to be, as they've got at home.
Caroline shows me one of her favourite places.
You're looking down on grass fields, and I know it's cliché, England's green and pleasant land. Out here, it's normally about 2 degrees difference in heat because you're looking dead south. And this is the obvious place to come and have a drink of an evening. And you would do it more often. I don't think I've been out here for maybe twice last year. Because in the old days, if somebody brought you the drink, of course you're delighted to drink it here. But if you've got to go and make the drink yourself, and the kitchen is the other end of the house, by the time you've actually got the ice bucket out and everything, you're so desperate you've drunk the drink before you get back.
This wasn't what I expected from a visit to a British country house. That it's a burden and an obligation to look after it.
To explain to anybody class is almost impossible. An easy one is, say, you've got working class, middle class, upper class, and above that is aristocracy. The aristocracy are closely linked with the royals, and they were the families which can trace themselves right back with titles and manorial lands, I suppose. I certainly wouldn't count myself as an aristocracy. We would be upper middle because we made our money in the industrial time.
It's clear that class isn't necessarily about how much money you have, but it may be when you made the money and how you keep hold of it. Professor Michael Savage is an expert in social class at the London School of Economics. I asked him to help me make sense of how class is changing.
The British have been obsessed with class forever, really. The obsession is partly to do with the fact that we like to think of ourselves as being a democracy. We like to think of ourselves as being, you know, equal. At the same time, we realise that we're not equal and that there are very big inequalities in our society. And thinking about class is our way of understanding that. I do think that the ideas of class are changing. There used to be a strong view that the main class divisions between working class, middle class and aristocracy or upper class. I think that's shifted. And I think what's happened in recent years has been a growing sense that the elite are pulling apart. They're very well off and quite aloof. Within the middle ranges of the class structure, much less certainty about where you fit.
So you mean there are actually people who don't know which class they belong to?
Well, the British are very unusual. If you ask people in most countries which class do you think you belong to, most people in most nations will say the middle class in Europe or North America. People are happy with that. It means they're not really affluent and really elite. It also means they're not at the bottom. But in Britain, we're the only major society in the world where over half of people still say they're working class, which is kind of odd because, you know, we've lost our factories, we've lost our coal mining and all that sort of industrial sector. And I think hanging on to this notion of a working class identity is saying that there are still connotations about if you say you're middle class, you're making claims to be a bit superior.
For the British, sometimes it's much better to downplay your origins.
All the ones, 11. 72.
Didcot has been described as the most normal town in England. When I told friends from outside the UK that there is such a thing as a normal British town, they found the idea hilarious. But when I visited it to meet people playing bingo, it turned out being normal is, well, maybe not that normal after all.
It's wonderful to think I'm in a normal town, considering I'm pretty abnormal. I'm not your normal. I'm a bit mental, you know. I love bingo. I love Didcot.
If you had to explain to a Swedish person what a normal British person is like, how would you explain it?
That's a difficult one.
What do you think makes a British person British?
Manners, politeness. We do Britishy things.
What is a Britishy thing?
Oh, fry up in the mornings, cup of tea.
The British, or should that be the English, take great pride in being an island nation with a great seafaring tradition. Lord West is a retired admiral and a former First Sea Lord of the British Royal Navy.
Everyone in Britain is aware that we are an island, and that means you have precise and defined borders, unlike being in Benelux, for example. If you're Belgium, Luxembourg, you're wandering around, you don't quite know where you are at times, but here, you know, you fall in the sea if you get off, so to speak. And the furthest point from the sea in this country is only about 45 miles from tidal water, salt water, 45 miles. That is not very much, really. It's extraordinary. We say, should we join Europe? Well, we are part of, you know, geographically we're part of Europe, even though we're an island. But mentally, quite a lot of people don't see that. They think we've joined Europe. Well, now we won't be in Europe, which is extraordinary. And I think that is to do with a sea boundary, the fact you're delineated very clearly from your neighbours. And it goes back centuries, of course.
The reticence of people in Didcot to describe themselves as normal is typical of the British, as Lord West points out.
A British value straight away is not to talk about British values. That's not what we do. You know, that's not very British, is it? I mean, there are lots of unwritten things in ways one behaves, which actually, when you analyse, you say, oh, that's quite British, actually, the way he's done that.
I'm taken back to that interview with David Crockett right on the border between the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland.
You know, nationality doesn't help you if you go down, if you come a checkpoint down there and you says, well, I'm British, you know, and I have a ground out here, you know, or I'm Irish and, you know, want to come up here. They'll just look at you. Well, that's tough. I don't care what you are. You still, it doesn't make any difference.
But of course, Brexit is forcing the British to talk about who they are. And that's what I will explore in the second part of A Swedish Ambassador's Guide to Britain.
The documentary is just one of our BBC World Service podcasts. There are many others to choose from. When you've finished listening to this edition, you could try Global News.
Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, whatever the time of day, there is one place to go if you want to know what's going on in the world. The Global News Podcast. I'm Jackie Leonard and I'm one of the presenters. The great thing is, we make new editions of our podcast 7 days a week, bringing you unrivaled reporting and analysis from our correspondents around the world. You may be one of the many who listen already. Hello. And if you're not, do join us and see what you've been missing. Search for Global News wherever you get your podcasts. That's Global News from the BBC World Service.
Now, let's return to the documentary.
This is the BBC World Service. My name is Nicola Klasa, a former Swedish ambassador to the UK. And this is my attempt to find out more about how the people of Britain see their country. A Swedish ambassador's guide to Britain. One thing is for sure, war. World War I, World War II, the Falklands War is ingrained in the British psyche.
The actual day of fighting was very intense, yes it was. Because I'd been hit by a number of bombs, I was on fire, I'd lost all my main armament, all my main weapon systems are gone, I only had some machine guns left. And a couple of Mirages turned in towards the ship, low-level running in, firing cannon at us to drop bombs.
That, by the way, is Lord West, former First Sea Lord, describing his experience in command of a frigate, HMS Ardent, during the Falklands War in 1982.
And then I was aware of someone by the side of me. It was my steward, with a silver salver and a cup of tea. And I said, what the hell are you doing? And he said, it's tea time, sir.
A cup of tea during a war. Could anything be more British?
So I grabbed my tea, and then he looked out the window and went, bloody hell, and toddled off. And I thought, well, that's very, you know. And of course, the funny thing is then, the message that goes on down to someone else below, where it's all pretty horrible, is what the skipper doing, he's just having a cup of tea. You know, well, that can't be too bad then, can it? But it was unpleasant, and sadly, I lost 22 of my boys, and I lost my ship, of course, as well. And I had a large number injured. And so that was horrible. And I think there is a British phlegm at times, a sort of calmness.
Ah, British calmness in the face of adversity. One of the UK's most popular modern-day slogans, featured on mugs, tea towels, T-shirts and posters, the length and breadth of the nation reads, keep calm and carry on. It was devised to maintain morale in World War II, but never actually used. But with typical British wit and practicality, it's been dusted off and given a prosperous second chance. Keep calm and carry on. To some, it may seem a bit ridiculous, but Lord West says that may just be the point.
We are very quick to be able to see the ridiculous and see the ridiculous in ourselves. Most decent people are willing to take the mickey out of themselves when they realise they're doing something. I think we like to deflate pomposity, and that's very amusing. I'm not sure that's the case with the EU in Brussels.
Whoa, I'll return to Britain's relationship with Europe later, but for now, let's just accept Lord West's view that the British have a particular sense of humour, and the rest of Europe, well, let's say we don't always appreciate it.
I mean, one of the things that I didn't like about Europe, and although I felt we should remain, was the bureaucracy there, which I thought was stultifying and drear and boring. And you can't make jokes. I mean, I was involved in NATO in Brussels, and I had to redo the NATO intelligence manual after the collapse of the Warsaw Pact. And sometimes dealing with bureaucrats, the NATO bureaucrats, was just awful. It was like wading through treacle. I mean, you felt like shooting yourself at the end of the day. There was no spark, there was nothing. And then when I became a minister and I got involved with the EU bureaucracy, it was even worse.
I mean, this Brexit, I think, was the best thing that's ever happened to England, because I don't agree why Brussels should tell us what we can and can't do.
That's Les Hepworth. I met him in Dewsbury, a town in the north of England, in Yorkshire.
I think Brexit's a good thing because, like I said, I think Britain be able to make its own laws rather than having to do what Europe says. It's not going to solve anything. I don't think it's going to make us any richer or any poorer. I just think that we're going to be able to govern ourselves rather than be told what to do by Europe. I don't see why, after 1945, when the war finished, which must have been a horrendous time for that 5-6 years, which Europe then becoming to peace, but Germany's a big say in what happens in Europe, France, Belgium and all them. But we sort of went out and tried to help them out, and now they're telling us what we should and shouldn't do. It should be the other way. Britain should be proud and strong, and we should be telling them what to do. We should be saying, this is what we want, and this is what we're going to have. And if you don't like, and that's what they said, the British people have said, we don't like what Europe is telling us to do, and we want out of it. So, at the end of the day, I think it's right, because Britain should speak for itself, not have anybody else speaking for it.
Les runs a working man's club today. His life has changed dramatically since he first went to work as a miner.
That was in 1970. And I can remember my words were when I went for the interview at the coal mines was, what do you want a job here for, he says to me. I says, well, it's a job for life. and that was in 1970. A job for life it was.
Except it wasn't.
In 84, after the strike, what happened? They all got shut. And now there's none left whatsoever.
What was the reaction when they closed down the big coal mines in the area?
Well, I mean, this area, there were a lot of miners in this area. It was a big mining town sort of thing. Round it, there were coal mines everywhere. And when the mine shut, some people never found work again.
What was it like? I mean, when you worked in the coal mines, what was it like down in the mine?
Well, the coal mine, you're like a brotherhood, I'll put it that way. I mean, you went through blood, sweat and tears together, and you're like a little family.
With no mines, Les found work in the car industry.
Now, there again, that was another good job, well paid, booming at that time. And then the car industry had gone within 8 years.
And so to stacking shelves in a supermarket.
Which was the most monotonous, boring job I've ever had in my life.
The fact that Britain appears to have lost its proud place in the world as an industrial nation, a miner of coal and maker of steel, is one of the most profound changes felt in the country. To many in the north of England, in Wales and Scotland, it's a rich heritage that has been surrendered too easily by politicians in the south, dreaming of a white-collar, high-tech second industrial revolution. Les' description of how his life changed is a powerful one and reflects a British social class divide, as Professor Michael Savage of the London School of Economics explained to me.
It always has been important in British culture that, you know, we think about the soft south and the hard north of England, and we think about Scotland and Wales as being working class countries. And so we had the industrial north. That's where you had the kind of the working class with the cloth caps and the, you know, greyhound racing and so forth. You had London and the southeast, rural, pastoral. That's where the kind of middle class and upper classes were based. So we have that very strong heritage. But what has happened really over the last 30 years has been that the north-south divide has in a way given way to the kind of London versus the rest divide, as I would see it. Or possibly you might want to call it the urban versus the rural divide. But people living in the peripheral areas, in the old industrial regions, feel neglected, and they see themselves as being kind of left out compared to these sort of swish urban centres.
The view from areas like Scotland can be a worrying one, as hairdressers Alan and Eileen have noticed among their customers.
I think people worry a little more.
About the way the world is in general. Yeah. Like, people are terrified.
And I just feel there is a lot of tension amongst people.
There's a lot of uncertainty, and I think a lot of people are quite scared
about the future.
Not knowing the future and what's going to happen or what's not going to happen. I mean, even me personally, I feel there's so much going on in the political world. I kind of sometimes tend to just be so exhausted by just the small, you know, headlines that I see, that I actually just choose to sometimes just not even read about it, which sounds terrible.
Les, Alan and Aileen, each in their way, touch key questions about the challenges facing contemporary British identity, something that Professor Savage was able to highlight when I asked him what Britishness meant to him.
Well, I mean, I'm 58 years old. I went to school in the 70s. In those days, you know, I remember my geography lessons at school, there still was that strong sense about the British Empire. And I don't think the British have really got to terms with what it means not to have an empire, to be honest. And I think we're living in the aftermath of Britain not being a very important country in the world anymore. And, you know, trying to think about what does it mean to be British in that kind of post-imperial, very globalised context. And so I think you still... And I think the Brexit vote was very much about quite a lot of British people saying, no, we are still an important nation. I mean, this is the kind of Nigel Farage view of the country. Failing to recognise that Britain isn't really a major player anymore. But you still find that nostalgic harking back to a kind of British imperial culture. So I think Britishness has increasingly become a sense of resentment, actually. And hence, I think the EU and the Brexit vote was partly about resentment against Europe, which was seen as a kind of the force which controls us.
Memories of the empire might feed a resentment among older people, but what of the young people whose only experience of empire might be from watching the many costume dramas on British TV. What do they make of their changing country? One thing that struck me during my time as ambassador was, where was the voice of the young at this momentous time for their country? Kat Hobbs is a young activist in her early 30s who set up a lobbying group called We Own It, arguing in favour of public ownership, a policy out of favour in Britain since the days of Margaret Thatcher in the early 1980s, but which was championed by Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn in the June 2017 election and proved popular with many younger voters.
When I started We Own It back in 2013, it felt like quite a radical proposition, even though to me it was just common sense, to be saying, you know, we want public ownership of the railway, we want public ownership of water, we want it to work for people rather than for profit. But now, because of Labour's manifesto and the public discussion that that's generated, the debate has really shifted.
I asked Kat how this shift in thinking might be reflected in terms of Britishness.
I think that's a really difficult question. I don't have a definition of Britishness. I have a set of images and ideas in my head.
What are those?
Tea, colonialism, the Royal Mail. For me, national boundaries are, I don't know, I guess in a sense they're quite arbitrary. And in another sense, there's shared history. And I think for humans in general, we like to have a sense of place. And we get identity from our sense of place and our connections with each other that are geographical. And it's important that they are geographical. But, I mean, I'm not particularly proud to be British.
Why?
You know, because I think we have a pretty dodgy past of dominating other countries around the world. But I do think, and this is for me, the link back to public ownership is there are some things, you know, there are some ways in which we need to build new public ownership, new economic institutions. We need to learn from different countries around the world and copy best practice. So we need to say, okay, Paris has taken water into public ownership. How can we copy Paris? But at the same time, there are some institutions that we've done really well. Like, you know, our Met Office is one of the top two global forecasters in the world. It's a publicly owned institution. It makes a profit. It does a brilliant job. We should be proud of that. Our Royal Mail, before it was privatised, it was a 500-year-old organisation working well in public ownership. And, you know, it was the Royal Mail. So it was sort of, you know, British in that sense. Our Royal Mint is the oldest example that we have of public ownership.
What does Lord Hague make of this generational gap?
There is a big generational gap. It's now, it was the biggest determinant of how people voted in the referendum, how old they were. Most people who were, broadly speaking, if you were over the age of 47, you voted to leave the EU, and if you were under 47, you voted to remain. And so this is a big divide, and there's also a divide about economics, about career expectations, whether people have pensions, whether they can afford housing. And we saw this in our general election, this surge in support for the Labour Party promising to abolish university tuition fees that reflected this discontent of young people with their prospects in society.
Is this change also affecting how the British view their parliament? Betty Boothroyd was the first woman to be Speaker of the House of Commons.
I was an only child in a rather poor family in Yorkshire. But I was born in an area, I think, and in a society where people were judged by their social class. It was almost a sort of caste system without the religion being there. The social class structure, I felt, as I was growing up, was really rather a British obsession, which I hope we're doing away with now, and I believe we are doing away with it.
And when you say obsession, what do you mean by that?
Well, the odds are that if you were born into what was called the working class, you would die in it, and that was the obsession, really, and that no longer applies.
Betty herself moved a long way from her roots. Here's how.
I love dancing. I love to dance. There was a period when I was quite young, a young teenager, and I wanted to become a professional dancer. My father thought it wasn't a decent thing for a working class girl. Anyway, we had rows at home. My mother won. Let her get it out of her system, she said. You know, women are very practical like that, and I did. I did go up to London, and I did dance. I was a huge flop. I wasn't a success at all, and I didn't like it, and I soon left it and went back to my real love of politics.
It was politics which took her to a role centre stage in Britain's democracy as the first female speaker of the House of Commons, a job which also involves dressing up.
I was so fortunate and lucky to become speaker. But there was one thing I felt I could not do, and that was I found it difficult to wear the full bottom wig and to have a sense of humour at the same time. Just after I was elected that same day, I said to the clerk of the House, I can't possibly wear the wig. Madam Speaker-elect, he said. You must remember the words, the wise words of Speaker Lenthal, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. King Charles came into the chamber and insisted that the Speaker do his bidding. He wanted four members to take to the Tower. And the Speaker Lenthal knelt on his knee, and he said, Sire, I have only eyes to see and ears to hear as this House bids me whose Speaker I am. You are, Madam Speaker-elect, the servant of this House and not his master. But we will seek permission of the House for you not to wear the wig. And we sought permission, and that was the right thing to do.
Wearing ceremonial robes in Parliament is one of many conventions which the British take pride in. That said, it is a feature which hasn't been repeated in the devolved government of the Scottish Parliament and the Assemblies of Wales and Northern Ireland. The dresses are said to carry a degree of formality and dignity which is important for civilised debate. Yet, despite that, I recall being quite astonished by the trenchant nature of debate in the House of Commons. British politics can be quite adversarial, and compromise is often seen as a sign of weakness.
It's the same old story. You can't trust the Tories on the NHS.
The same old, usual, feeble, pre-scripted lines. He practices them every week. I'm sure they sound fantastic in the bathroom mirror.
I asked William Hague about humour in Parliament.
There are some bigger differences in politics now than even 10 or 15 years ago. Tony Blair and I, when he was Prime Minister and I was leader of the opposition, in retrospect were arguing about quite small things, about a small difference in what the rate of tax should be or how public services should be reformed, compared to the argument now between Jeremy Corbyn, a far-left Labour leader, and Theresa May implementing Brexit. Now the differences are much greater. Politics has become more polarised, and perhaps that does lead to less humour.
It's a conundrum that Aisha Malik recognises as a novelist who writes about the experiences of her character, Sophia Khan.
I refer to my character Sophia Khan as a Muslim Bridget Jones. Bridget Jones is a character that I've grown up knowing and loving, and that we've all grown up knowing and loving. But what's always jarred for me is such different lifestyles. I could identify with Bridget Jones to a certain extent, but then I couldn't identify with the part where she drinks or where she's having sex before marriage, for example. And so when I created Sophia Khan, I wanted her to have an essence of Bridget Jones, but with a Muslim twist, because it is different.
We met in a quintessential English village pub to talk, and Aisha explained what it means to be a Muslim in the modern UK.
I always refer to myself as British Muslim. I don't know what comes first or what comes second. However, in the past few years, I've been really thinking about Englishness and why it is so difficult to say I am English, even though I was born in England. Pakistan to me is not home. I speak Urdu, but it's not my mother tongue. So why can I not call myself English? And in my head, I feel that Englishness is linked to being white. Englishness isn't brown. And I feel that now even if you're brown or black, you should be able to call yourself English. Why not? If England is all you've known, if that's your mother tongue, if that's where you've been born and brought up, if that's what you want to adopt as your identity, it should be your right to do so. However, I know that if I go out, people often ask me, where are you from? And I say, London. And they said, no, but where are you originally from? And I say, do you mean where are my parents from? Because I'm originally from London. My parents are from Lahore. And I feel that if I said I'm English, people would balk at the idea, you know, what rights do I have to claim English as my identity? I feel I'm within perfect rights to do that. But I feel that others perhaps might not have the same view of it.
So that's something that you feel when you're out there?
Yes, absolutely. And it's something that I want to address more so now than ever. God save our
gracious queen. If identity is a challenge for the British, how does the world regard British identity? Who better to ask than a group of people who joined the queue to become British citizens?
You see, what makes us British is not what we look like. It's not any one culture or the different religions we practice.
And it's not. Here's the Mayor of London welcoming 32 of them to their new nationhood.
It's our collective adherence to a set of values and principles. Democracy, justice, tolerance, equality and opportunity.
My name is Guillaume Rey. I come from Provence in the south of France.
Congratulations. That was a very nice ceremony.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
How does it feel?
I did feel quite emotional about it. And the, maybe it's a whole ceremony and the singing, which was quite nice, actually.
My name is Magda. I'm Polish. I came from Poland 11 years ago. During the ceremony, I was extremely happy and proud and very calm. And also, I had that feeling that I'm such a lucky person because we were chosen to be here today with the Mayor of London. So I somehow felt privileged as well.
It forced you to think a lot more when you actually get that. I mean, to think in terms of, you know, what are the values? And I probably have a sense, but maybe I should give it more thinking as I progress. But generally, it comes as well in terms of what are going to be my duties. Are these duties going to change? I mean, I'm thinking about the vote and all the responsibility that goes with it. So it's something that you don't really think about until you actually become British. And then you build up from that, I would say.
What is Britishness to you?
I don't think there is one definition, right? Otherwise, I mean, it would be in the dictionary. I looked at it before coming and I couldn't find anything. When I compare to France, I mean, obviously, both countries, in my view, share very much the same value, democracy, equality, etc. When I think about what really stands out for Britain, I think potentially tolerance is really something that really stands out. Maybe it's because I live in London, but I think when you look at the history and how big and impactful Britain used to be, I think there has been so much exposure to various civilizations, to various cultures, and you can really feel it, especially when you live in London. So I think tolerance would be, I think, a key one in my view. But I'm sure there is a lot more that I need to learn and that I need to develop. Maybe I can work on my sense of humor. I mean, maybe that's going to be a tough one. But you know, that's really how I look at it.
Do you get British humor?
I think I read somewhere that the difference between the British sense of humor and the French sense of humor, that the French laugh at others and the British laugh at themselves. So it's quite a game changer. So I have to learn to laugh at myself. But presumably it's something that I can learn.
As I heard these new British citizens talking about what they're going to learn about their new country, I also reflected on what I've learned about Britishness. My journey across the whole of the UK offered great conversations with people from all walks of life. People were very willing to engage and gave many perspectives, but no comprehensive answer to what Britishness constitutes. In fact, the more people tried to explain Britishness, the more abstract the term became. Taking the pulse of a nation is incredibly difficult. There is, however, a sense that Britain will have to carve out a new place in the world after Brexit, And that will be the major challenge for the country for many years to come.
I'm Nicola Klaase. Thank you for listening to my Swedish Ambassador's Guide to Britain for the BBC World Service. The producers were Joe Fidgen and Phil Rivell.
One thing I can say for sure about the British, they do love their dogs. Thank you for listening.
Oh, the dogs are off again.
I'm sorry, it was getting... They were quiet. They love it. They just love ragging the whole time. It's slightly embarrassing when you're showing people around the house and things. But they'll shut up in a minute. They're just... Stop it, dog, stop it. I will put the dogs away in a minute. Dogs, stop it, stop it.
Thank you for listening. There will be more from the documentary podcast soon. If you haven't already, please do subscribe. And don't forget, do try our other BBC World Service podcasts too.